Puerto Rico gets a message from Trump today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump went to Puerto Rico today.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
But Puerto Ricans say the recovery is only just begun.
$40 to $60 billion. We're going to need that kind of money right away in order to hold on to the population, give people hope, and get some level of normality.
And as Puerto Rico struggles with the effects of extreme weather, Alaska copes with a slow-moving climate disaster.
We were working intensively with the White House. Unfortunately, it's unclear to me if that work is now continuing at the federal level.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We start this Tuesday with a number, 23. That's how many guns police say the shooter in Las Vegas had with him in his hotel room on Sunday night. But what's still not clear is why. Why Stephen Paddock carried out the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Investigators say they found no evidence of any links between Paddock and any terrorist group. But that's not what ISIS wants us to believe. They claimed responsibility just hours after the shooting. In an online statement, they said Paddock had recently converted to Islam and was inspired by ISIS to carry out the attack. Terrorism experts are skeptical of the claim, so we got in touch with Rukmini Kalamaki of the New York Times, who covers ISIS and their operations. Now, you had your doubts pretty soon after ISIS claimed credit for the shooting in Las Vegas. Why is that?
Well, the first thing that I looked at was what was known about the shooter. And as soon as I found out that he was a white male who was 64 years old, I started to question their claim. That's not to say that a 64-year-old who happens to be white can't be a member of ISIS, but that's very much an outlier in terms of the demographics that we know of ISIS fighters in the U.S. Young, digital natives, and some of them with troubled pasts. The oldest American recruit to the Islamic State is a woman who happened to be 55.
Talk a little bit about the language that ISIS uses in their claims of responsibility. They called the Las Vegas shooter a, quote, soldier of the Islamic State. What did that tip you off to?
Soldiers of the Islamic State are their members in Iraq and Syria who are fighting on the front line in Mosul, as well as anyone who carries out an act in their name abroad. All of them are called soldiers of the Islamic State. What is more interesting is that they say that he, quote, responded to calls to target the coalition. That's a reference to a speech by the ISIS spokesman in 2014, where he called out to their global community and said to them, you don't need to come to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. You can kill the infidel right there at home. So that language suggests that this would have been an inspired attack rather than a directed one by the Islamic State.
ISIS has doubled down on this claim, even tripled down.
Yes.
Is that normal?
Well, it's normal if it's a signature attack that they really did do. If the evidence doesn't emerge and there is no ISIS link here, which is what we're looking at right now, I think ISIS will have, you know, blown a mile-wide hole in their credibility. This is a group that has been relatively disciplined in only claiming attacks that they did themselves or that were carried out by people who were inspired by them. There have been exceptions, and there have been a couple of high-profile mistakes this year. There was a bomb plot that they claimed at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. It turned out to be false. And there was the claim of an attack on a resort in Manila, which authorities in the Philippines say was not linked to ISIS.
So why might this be happening, this kind of measured increase in false claims?
There's a number of theories. I mean, keep in mind, ISIS is a group that has been losing both ground as well as personnel. We know that they have lost several senior figures, including the founder of the Amaq News Agency, which is the body within ISIS that puts out these claims. So one working theory is that as they lose personnel, they're getting sloppier. I don't believe one of the currents of thought among certain experts is that ISIS is actively trying to deceive us. And the reason I don't believe it is because evidence has emerged from one member of Amaq who was arrested in Germany, showing the extent he went to try to confirm claims of responsibility. They gave the example of an attack that happened in Europe, I believe in Sweden. And in the records, we learned that he tried to contact the source in Sweden to try to figure out, was that guy really acting in the name of the Islamic State? And only when he got the confirmation did he go out and publish it on the terror group's platform.
So the FBI says there's no evidence that ISIS had anything to do with what happened in Las Vegas. You kind of tipped to this earlier. How much is this going to affect ISIS's credibility with its followers?
Well, ISIS members in general don't believe what the Western media says anyway. They've grown up in this culture where everything that I at the New York Times publishes is propaganda for the U.S. government. So it's possible that they will take it as, oh, it's just the Western media and the Western government hiding the great martyrdom of our brother.
So just to be clear, Rukmini, your belief is that there is no ISIS connection to the shooting in Las Vegas or the shooter, but one may still emerge.
At this point, we have no evidence to suggest a link. In order to be considered an ISIS recruit in my book, you have to be carrying out the act in the name of this terrorist group. That has to be your intention. And I'm just waiting to see what the investigation finds. And for me, the most important thing is what will they find on his phone and on his laptop? Because those are the devices that ISIS recruits all over the world use to communicate with their handlers within the terrorist group.
Rukmini Kalamaki covers ISIS for the New York Times. Thank you very much, Rukmini. Good to speak.
My pleasure, Marco. Take care.
When it comes to guns like the ones used in the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the U.S. is in many ways an outlier. If you compare us to countries around the world, the U.S. is by far the largest exporter and importer of so-called small arms. Those are weapons designed for individual use, and that includes semi-automatic rifles.
They tend to be the weapon that is most used in things that we're concerned about, criminal violence through to human rights abuses.
Nick Marsh is with the Peace Research Institute, Oslo. He contributed research to the Small Arms Survey, which tracks small arms production and trade around the world. So first of all, Nick, we've got to break down all of this in terms of countries that actually provide transparent access to their manufacturing and export numbers, like countries like Iran and North Korea, for example. We don't really know that much, correct?
Not very much at all for those countries. But we have pretty good data on where we know most of the production is. And the U.S. is the largest exporter and importer, but you also have large industries and large exporters in countries like Germany, Italy, and other parts of Western Europe. And then outside, you've got Brazil's got a large industry, large exports, Israel, China as well.
Nick, if you take a country like Italy or Germany, which are 2 and 4, respectively, of the top small arms exporters, are they high in the rankings because their gun control laws are so tight that they look elsewhere for more open markets like the U.S. to sell their products?
There's quite a lot of firearms in Germany and Italy. But they're mostly shotguns, guns which are used for hunting. And what you have is sort of industries producing for domestic markets in those countries, as I say, things like shotguns, but also selling large quantities of things like pistols to the United States. So the U.S. market is sucking in sort of firearms from the rest of the world. And you've got some countries like Croatia, their industry is basically geared up to supply the U.S. Market. It doesn't really export very much to anywhere else.
And here in the U.S., the market for these small weapons is civilians. How does that compare with other countries that actually produce these weapons?
In the U.S., it's by far the greatest market segment is civilians. You've got roughly about 270 to 300 million, depending on who's doing the estimate, guns in civilian hands. And then you've got about 2.2 million in the armed forces, including reserves, probably about 1.2 million or so police officers. So, the civilian holdings of weapons in the U.S. are enormously larger than the government. In somewhere like Japan, where they have very strict firearms regulations, then, the balance is the other way, that the government has far more guns. In other countries where you have differing regulations, such as Germany, Sweden, Finland, you probably find a majority of guns are in civilian hands, but not nearly as many as in the United States.
Yeah, and just on a final note, Nick, that is, I guess, harder to kind of track with real data. As you looked at other countries, how do they see the U.S. with this muscular importing and exporting ability with firearms?
Well, a lot of the action is just not really understanding it. I mean, the rest of the world doesn't really think of firearms in that way. I mean, there's lots of places where you have fairly high ownership of firearms, for example, Norway, but they're a piece of sports equipment. You don't have the relationship between sort of ownership for firearms and, you know, personal protection or things like that. You know, if people have one, it's something that's kept locked up the whole time because it's potentially dangerous sports equipment. It's not something that you want to carry around with you all the time.
Nick Marsh there with the Peace Research Institute Oslo. He was speaking with us from Norway. Thousands of Catalans took to the streets in protest today. Their anger was aimed at Spain's central government and its efforts to stop the Catalan independence referendum this past weekend. Spanish police used force and rubber bullets to keep voters from casting their ballots. But as we reported yesterday, the vote went ahead, and so are the protests now. Our reporter Jerry Haddon in Barcelona has been to some of these protests. Catalans declared this day, Jerry, a general strike. What does it look like and what is the mood on the streets today?
It looks, when you're not downtown, like a ghost town in most parts of the city. Stores are shuttered. The trains and subways are not running. Very few taxis on the road. In the center of town, the mood is one of indignation, I'd say. There are tens of thousands of people gathering in one of the main plazas, and the crowd stretches for at least a mile down a broad avenue, people waving the Catalan flag and chanting that the streets belong to them. They're indignant because of what we've been reporting on this week, what they believe to be the disproportionate use of violence by national police forces who were sent out to break up Sunday's vote on the referendum to leave Spain.
And what were you hearing from people when you spoke with them and asked them about, you know, their reaction to the vote and the crackdown and out of the future?
People today are essentially still sort of reeling, you know, in disbelief that that such force was used against them. I was at a meal that was organized in a public space in front of the local mayor's office in my neighborhood at midday today. And, you know, it was sort of a fun event organized for kids. But as soon as they put the tables away and everyone started marching down the hill to join this larger rally against the police oppression, people's faces sort of went serious and you could see them steeling themselves, you know, for another afternoon of protest. And their feeling was, and what they've been expressing to me is that this cannot stand. And it's just, you know, deepened their resolve to push and push for independence.
Barcelona is, of course, in the heart of Catalonia, and presumably this doesn't look like what's happening in the rest of Spain. But do you have a better sense today where the momentum now lies? Will the pro-independence forces be able to get some concessions from the government?
It still looks like it's going to be a tough one for the independence-minded folks here in Catalonia. The president of Catalonia, Carles Puigdemont, has been saying since the Sunday vote, in which over 2 million Catalans allegedly voted and in which allegedly 90% voted for independence, that he can now unilaterally declare independence. But at the same time, he's urging the international community to send mediators to help negotiate a solution. So he's clearly using the vote as a wedge to pressure not only the Spanish government, but to bring in outside help. There is a slim chance that the European Union could step in as a mediator, but so far, up to now, Brussels' main point has been that this is an internal matter, even as it has said it's worrying, the images it's seen of the violence that took place on Sunday. And then you have the central government in Madrid essentially, you know, digging in its heel and saying, you know, we're open to the dialogue, but we're not going to talk about independence. We're not going to talk about reforming the constitution to make secession a possibility. So we're still at loggerheads.
And the strike carries on through this week?
Well, a watered-down version of it today, because the motivation for today's strike was in protest against police violence. The strike that is due to last through October 13th is for Catalan independence, or the right at least to vote on independence. And you'll see all of the major Spanish unions, the national unions, backing out of that protest. So it remains to be seen how effective it will be as a leverage point for the Catalan government.
Reporter Jerry Haddon in Barcelona, thanks very much for the update, Jerry.
You bet, Marco.
Just ahead on the show, looking beyond Catalonia to the future of the nation state. Yeah, only on the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World, where we don't just cover the breaking news from around the globe. We also think about the big picture. And following independence votes in both Catalonia and Kurdistan recently, I have a lot of big picture questions, like when is secession a good idea? Or what is the future of nation states? Malka Older has unique perspectives on all of this. In her sci-fi thrillers Infomocracy and Null States, she imagines a new international order where nation states as we know them don't exist anymore. So I asked Malka to describe what she's envisioned as an alternative.
So the model that I propose in my book, which isn't necessarily supposed to be a perfect model, it's more supposed to be kind of a thought experiment that gives us an idea of the other directions that we could go, the alternatives that we're not looking at right now because we're so involved with nation states. The model in the book is what I call micro-democracy. And in it, the nation state has been replaced by a jurisdictional unit that's called a sentinel. And it's basically a group of 100,000 people. It's based on population, not geography. So that 100,000 people could be in a very dense couple of city blocks in Dhaka or New York, or it could be spread over hundreds of square miles in the steppe or the Australian outback. So it's about population. And those groups, those sentinels, can choose any government that they want in an election from all of the governments that are functioning in the world. So by government, I mean set of laws, procedures, processes, rules, cultural identification, whatever that government decides is important for defining their law and their unity.
How did you come up with this, Malka? Like what realities kind of led you to this new world?
So it really was about the issue that we're talking about today, which is about secession and separatist movements. I worked as an aid worker and as a development worker in a lot of countries that had active, often violent secessionist movements. So Sri Lanka, for example, Sudan, where the secessionist movement has, one of the movements has since resulted in the most recent nation state in the world, which is South Sudan. I worked in a different part in Darfur where it hasn't been successful. I worked in Indonesia, where East Timor was the nation state that split off prior to South Sudan. And as I was watching this happen in the places that I was working, I also became more and more aware that it occurred pretty much everywhere in the world. So also the places that I went to study or for vacation or to travel, we're seeing now obviously in Spain, but also in the United Kingdom, with Scotland, in France, in Italy, pretty much every nation in the world, including this one, has some degree of separatist or secessionist movement.
So having read Infomocracy, I thought of you recently when a friend of mine in Kenya asked rhetorically on Facebook, tell me why Africa shouldn't be divided into thousands of independent countries based on language and ethnicity. And I thought about that. In a way, that's kind of what we saw hinted at, and you referenced this too, in the secession referendum in Catalonia last weekend, leading to a violent crackdown. What we saw in Iraqi Kurdistan 2 weeks ago, which really upset Baghdad. What crossed your micro-democracy mind when those votes happened?
So as a general rule, I'm in favor of these things. I'm in favor of self-determination. On a personal side, I have some less good reasons for just having a natural inclination towards the secessionist movements, which is on the one hand, I am kind of in favor of underdogs, which is not a very good reason because one country's underdog is another country's oppressor, right? And I'm also kind of find it exciting and interesting when you have a new country wanting to come into the world stage, which is a really bad reason for being in favor because, you know, that means nothing to the people who are involved. But I also think that there are some very good reasons for being in favor of it.
Like
mainly
what?
Self-determination. Mainly the idea that, you know, when you look at the arguments against these referenda, I think there are good arguments against them as well that are possible from the economic side, from the political side. But I do think that those arguments have to come from the people involved, the people who would be splitting off, because those are the people most affected. And those aren't the arguments that are really being made in most of the mainstream press around these. Most of the arguments that are being made are it's illegal and otherwise, more generally, sort of arguments in favor of the status quo, arguments that if it happens here, it'll happen everywhere.
I mean, hit on that, because illegality is kind of a vague critique. But if I look at it closely, I can see how a nation like Spain that has relied on some kind of order for a century or more does not want to upset that order because of economic and political consequences. So, I mean, that's a problem, isn't it?
Well, I do think that there's an argument to be made about stability for economic and political reasons. But if you look at Spain's order for the past century, a lot of it has not been a very happy order.
Right.
You know, they had several decades of pretty ugly fascism and oppression under Franco, and before that, a civil war. And that is where a lot of this impulse towards independence is coming from. It's coming from the memory of a time when being part of this nation state was not a comfortable or pleasant it was not an experience that allowed Catalonia to fulfill its needs as a people. So, you know, I don't find that the order argument terribly convincing. And I think it's interesting to notice how these arguments, like the argument about legality, mirrors the arguments about immigration in this country.
How so? Walk us through that.
Well, here too, when we talk about immigration, a lot of times the argument that comes up against it is it's not legal. These people did something illegal. And that obscures, for one thing, the fact that there isn't, for many people and for many countries in talking about secession, there isn't a legal path to follow. So
kind of a priori, because why would a country want to allow anybody to leave the Union? Is that what you're saying?
Sure, but that's not actually true for all countries. So Scotland had a referendum, Quebec had a referendum, and those were both legal under their country's system of laws and constitution. So it's a bit of an arbitrary thing that this particular country decided that to have a referendum, to have a peaceful democratic means of looking at secession would be illegal. Just as it's kind of arbitrary to decide that some types of immigration are legal and others aren't, and not have either clarity or ways to do it legally. And so I think when people use those arguments, it hides the fact, it makes you think, oh, well, why didn't they just do it legally? When in fact, for many people, there's no possible way. For many regions and countries, there's no way to ask for, request a legal dissolution. And they also make it seem like those laws are just a priori the way things should be. And they kind of tend to prevent a discussion about whether those laws are either morally and ethically right, or from other perspectives, you know, from an economic or political perspective, whether that's the best choice for the country as a whole.
So final question. I'm just curious to know what you thought of the impulse that some people on the West Coast and other parts of the country too, but especially the West Coast, had after Trump was elected. California was proposing secession. Whether it was serious or not, what occurred to you?
Whether they're serious or not, I think, you know, that's a question for them. I think I tend to take a long view of things. You know, I think that nation states are not permanent. And their composition is not permanent. And the way people want to live their lives and the governments that we figure out are changing all the time. And so I don't think it's a bad thing to have these discussions. In fact, I think it's a great thing. I think it's really worth looking at what will make our countries work better, what will make our different ways that we can figure out to try and be more representative and reflect more what people need from their governments.
Malka, thanks so much for your thoughts and for having this discussion with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Malka Older is a political scientist and novelist. Her latest book is called Null States.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. As a kid, Rainer Weiss built his own hi-fi systems, but getting rid of that snap, crackle, and pop you get from vinyl records?
That was a puzzle that I was just beyond me. I couldn't do it. I didn't know enough math. I didn't know enough real electrical engineering. And effectively, that drove me to college.
Today, he is a Nobel laureate in physics. That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack. Because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
Yep, that's what President Trump said today as he visited Puerto Rico 13 days after the island was clobbered by Hurricane Maria. Since then, many Puerto Ricans have struggled just to connect with each other. New Yorker Hector Figueroa, for instance, still hasn't spoken with his 93-year-old father in the small town of Coamo.
You got to understand, the Puerto Rican family is a family that exists in two places, the U.S., for the most part, and then on the island.
Father and son were both born in Coamo. Hector Figueroa now lives in New York. He's a president of a local chapter there of the Service Employees International Union. But Puerto Rico is always on his mind these days.
This is a situation that all people who have a family member in Puerto Rico is experiencing. We cannot account for every member of our family. There are many cousins and aunts and uncles that we don't really know much about.
Yeah, and how are you trying to reach them?
There is a Zelle application that you can listen to conversations that people are having about who have they seen, what the state of the town is. It's really nerve-wracking. There is no simple A to B communication right now on the island. You have to rely on other people to hear about people you care about.
Yeah, nerve-wracking. And I suspect for people like you in a city like New York, many miles away from Puerto Rico, it's even more so.
It is tough. The one thing that I can really relate to, though, is that the entire community here in the States have opened their hearts and shared information, raised money and aid. Close to 4 million Puerto Ricans live in the States, and over 3 million Puerto Ricans live on the island, all of them American citizens. So we have 7 million Americans trying to cope with the reality of this hurricane.
Let me just ask you how your father is doing. What have you heard from your sister?
You know, he's 93 years old. He is a very, very smart 93 years old.
Wow, 93. That's amazing.
He's looking at this situation with patience and fortitude, but for how long, longer can he stand this situation? It's the part that makes me worry every day. But they are every day rationing their food, and they are safe. But the road to their home has been destroyed. They are relying on the community that they have built with neighbors to make sure that everybody eats, everybody is able to have water. They have no electricity, no running water.
Yeah,
this is one of the first towns to grow coffee in Puerto Rico. You know, it came in the 1700s. It will be many years before we see coffee being again, you know, growing in the hills of this town. And you have islands of communities now, isolated from each other, where it was the fortitude of people coming together that started to clear the roads, started to bring water to those who needed, and started to account for everyone. Luckily, nobody died that we know of, but there are some portions of the town that we have not been able to reach to.
I mean, the economics of Puerto Rico were already pretty shaky before the storm, and there's history here. You've written about how hedge funds are in part to blame for the shaky economic base in Puerto Rico. What is the link? It's not just a storm.
Yeah, it's not just a storm. Puerto Rico has been hard hit prior to the storm by really a collapsing economic model that relied on corporations establishing themselves in Puerto Rico, you know, because they would not pay corporate federal taxes. And that led to some kind of industrialization, but unfortunately, the rules and the conditions under which these corporations could operate was not controlled by Puerto Ricans, and Congress changed all the tax breaks and the incentives that attracted industry to the island. And having seen the collapse of agriculture some decades before, and then the collapse of industry, the Puerto Rican government had very much only local resources and borrowing to sustain the services that the population needed. So borrowing, it went, right? And right now, Puerto Rico owes a colossal amount of money, and this has just been aggravated by the hurricane.
And yet, President Trump actually scolded Puerto Rico for its debt, which the island, he tweeted, owes to Wall Street and the banks, which sadly must be dealt with. I mean, that must have hurt, not to mention the fact that suggests that Trump is not going to let Puerto Rico off the hook for this debt. Is that how you read that?
That's how I read it. It's very ironic because the president himself has relied on debt restructuring to be the successful businessman that he is today.
Mm.
We're just asking Puerto Rico to have the same opportunity, and the pushback is coming from hedge funds and others who bought the debt, you know, speculating that they will get a lot of money in return, and they just need to count their losses and realize that people's lives come above, you know, making a profit.
With the destruction and this uncertain future, many Puerto Ricans are going to come to the mainland, probably mostly Florida. Do you know many Puerto Ricans who are planning to leave and move stateside?
I know many who are already coming in Orlando, in Atlanta, and Texas. These are not Puerto Ricans who are going necessarily to the traditional places where the community has been for years because the cost of living is more challenging.
Right, but what impact is that migration going to have on the island?
It's going to really deplete the island from people with education, people who we need to rebuild the structure. This is why it's so imperative that the federal government injects real money into Puerto Rico. The damage from FEMA is estimated thus far, without the full accountability of the damage, in at least $40 to $60 billion. We're going to need that kind of money right away in order to hold on to the population, give people hope, and get some level of normality.
Hector Figueroa, president of the Service Employees International Union Local 32BJ, speaking with us from New York City. We are all thinking of the island of Puerto Rico and its people.
Thank you so much.
The relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico is complicated. Roots in the Spanish-American War of 1898, but also based in part on the island's 1952 Constitution, which officially made Puerto Rico a Commonwealth of the United States. Voters approved that document, but not without controversy. Some said it was nothing more than a tool of U.S. colonial power. That's the context in which these words were spoken.
Cuando tenemos la madre tendida sobre el lecho.
It's not easy giving a speech when our mother is lying on her deathbed and her murderer hovers above her. This is what is happening right now to our motherland, Puerto Rico. And the murderer is the power of the United States of America.
That's the voice of Pedro Albizu Campos, a leader of Puerto Rico's Nationalist Party, a hero for some Puerto Ricans. Campos was speaking in 1950, urging Puerto Ricans to embrace the drive for independence.
No se puede pronunciar un discurso.
You just can't give a speech when the newborns in our motherland are dying of hunger, when the adolescents are being poisoned by the worst kind of virus, the virus of slavery, when the adults of our motherland have to flee in fear from their hometowns, and have no other place to go but to the same enemy power that enslaves us. They have to go to the United States to become slaves of the very economic forces that hold our land hostage. They are the slaves who out of need head to Michigan, only to be scorned, exploited, and kicked there.
Campos also blasted the Senate in Washington for claiming to be a bastion of democracy while denying Puerto Ricans the right to choose their own destiny.
These are the so-called great Democrats today in the U.S. Senate. And according to them, Puerto Rico is content being an American possession, a thing that the U.S. can do whatever it likes with. It can choose to use our sons as Yankee soldiers. They can take all of our land. They can decree that all of Puerto Rico is a U.S. national park. They can decide that all monuments in Puerto Rico are Yankee monuments, property of the Yankees, administered by Yankees. And above all, that we are Yankees, because they say we are Yankees.
You were listening there to Puerto Rican nationalist leader Pedro Albizu Campos speaking in 1950. That speech was released years later by the Paradon Records label, and we have access to it as part of Future Folk, our new collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Center. While Puerto Rico has been coping with the immediate impact of extreme weather, many parts of the globe are worried about the longer-term impact of climate change. That is a big concern for leaders in many coastal cities, for example. But for people in Anchorage, Alaska, the concerns are even more dire. Here's the world's Jason Margolis with our 50 States Project.
The port of Anchorage is a lifeline for Alaska.
90% of all inbound cargo coming into Alaska comes via marine vessel. About half of that cargo comes through the port of Anchorage.
Jim Jager is the port's spokesperson. We were on a small boat cruising around the harbor. The port has a big problem. Its steel pilings are crumbling.
Our challenge is getting the docks replaced before they rust away.
How long do you have?
About 10 years.
The port is spending $700 million on the project. The problem isn't being caused by climate change, but warming temperatures are making things trickier. Alaska has warmed more than twice as fast as the rest of the country. Winters in Anchorage are 6 degrees warmer than they were 70 years ago. And that means nearby glaciers are retreating fast. The port's director, Steve Rebuffo, explains that those glaciers don't just hold water frozen in place. They hold rocks, sand, and dirt.
In a traditional Alaskan winter, all of that sedimentation is kind of frozen in place, and what comes down off the glaciers is minimized.
But the warmer it gets, the more silt flows down into the port. And that can mean more time and money spent on dredging. Then there's the threat from rising sea levels.
We already have the second highest tides in the world. I don't know what that's going to mean in the future.
Rebuffo is dealing with a lot of slow-moving uncertainties. What is certain Alaskan winters feel a whole lot different these days.
Nowadays, typically, the winter is a combination of snow and ice and rain and kind of dismal conditions.
I met environmental consultant Brian Hirsch at a restaurant in Anchorage. He's working with the city on a climate resiliency program. He says Alaskans love their cross-country skiing. These days, though, for them, it's kind of a bummer. Instead, you see lots of people riding fat tire bikes around town.
Oftentimes with studded tires because the historically nice snowy trails are now covered in ice.
Sure, not the end of the world, but it's a change in the quality of life. Still, Anchorage has much bigger climate change concerns.
Invasive species.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist with the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
In mid-2000s, we had an infestation of the spruce bark beetle, and that killed a lot of our white and black spruce trees, and they present a serious fire hazard.
A hazard that threatens parts of Anchorage, and it's made worse by those shorter, warmer winters. And then there's the pressure that's being put on Alaska's biggest city by what's happening in other parts of the state. Brian Hirsch works with indigenous communities in Alaska's far north. He says wildlife patterns are changing there, making hunting and fishing, basic survival, more difficult.
Anchorage is sort of the shock absorber to a lot of that, right? Similar to what you'd see maybe in a city in Africa, for example, where there's a lot more urbanization.
Hirsch says a lot of native Alaskans are being displaced by changing conditions and migrating to Anchorage, but without the tools they need to find work.
Within Anchorage, you see many people who are from villages with maybe great hunting and fishing skills, but not such developed skills for working in an office setting, for example.
What's happening here is most definitely going to be happening in other parts of the United States. It is one of the most complex issues that we will be faced as a human species.
Attorney Robin Bronin runs the Alaska Institute for Justice. She's working with 16 indigenous communities threatened by flooding and erosion from rising seas and thawing permafrost. She says these small villages want to stick together and don't want to move to Anchorage. President Obama had a task force addressing climate adaptation challenges like this.
We were working intensively with the White House. Unfortunately, it's unclear to me if that work is now continuing at the federal government level.
So add it all up, wildfires, invasive species, rising sea levels, and displaced people. That's a lot on the plate for the man in charge of Anchorage. Ethan Berkowitz is the city's mayor. He has a task force studying climate impacts, but basically no budget to address them.
It is an issue that I want to contend with. There's a moral responsibility that comes with it. But climate change is a slow burn. And a lot of the issues I have to contend with are on a much faster fuse.
His state is also grappling with a severe budget shortfall, so Berkowitz isn't getting much help from the capital, Juneau, these days. Still, he says the city can factor climate change into many of its development decisions. Berkowitz adds that Anchorage is trying to minimize its own impact by cutting its use of fossil fuels and turning more toward renewable energy. But that means confronting the state's lifeblood, oil. The state's long reliance on oil to drive its economy has made climate change a sticky issue for its elected officials, and many have simply ignored it. Berkowitz doesn't, but he's ambivalent. He says in a world that runs on oil, Alaska's industry is one of the most environmentally responsible. But he says you can't pretend climate change isn't real.
Blinding ourselves to truths because they're inconvenient is a form of folly. And that's an abdication of leadership when you do that.
Berkowitz says Alaskans need to do what Alaskans have always done. Get ready for extreme conditions the best way they can. For The World, Jason Margolis, Anchorage.
Jason's story from Anchorage is part of our 50 states coverage. We're looking at how globalization is affecting communities across the U.S. If you have a story you'd like to share with us, just go to PRI.org or tweet us using the hashtag 50 states. This is the season for no bells, and you never know, maybe this year you'll get that early morning call from the Swedish Academy. Last year, we got a bit ahead of ourselves when it came to interviewing Nobel laureates. We'd heard that a strong contender for the physics prize was Rainer Weiss, an MIT professor emeritus. So we asked Weiss to stop by our studio to talk about his work. Like I said, we were a little premature. He did not get the nod last year, but he did this year.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics with one half to Rainer Weiss and the other half jointly to Barry C. Barish and Kip S. Thorne.
Weiss and colleagues clinched the Nobel for dreaming up the idea behind the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. It's a sort of massive antenna so sensitive it detected faint invisible ripples in space from 1.3 billion years ago. You can even hear them. Yeah, listen up. I'm going to play that again. Back before it was cool, I asked Rainer Weiss, that's how he prefers to pronounce his name, to explain what that sound is.
That sound is two black holes that are going around each other in a orbit, and they are getting closer and closer, and they're losing energy as they do it. They get faster and faster, and they, in the few cycles you heard there, they emerge together and make a new black hole.
And then that sound is this gravitational wave that's arrived on planet Earth.
Well, be careful with the sound. Let's be honest about what it really is, okay?
Be honest.
What it is what an instrument records, like a phonograph, for example, and you amplify it with an amplifier, and then you listen to it through a loudspeaker. It isn't sound that traveled from there. It happens to be a gravitational wave that is at the frequencies that you can hear.
But that is so cool, though. I mean, 1.3 billion years ago.
That's fine. I'm not denying that. But it is, after all, it's not sound waves in outer space. There's no medium to carry sound waves.
So, Ray Weiss, let's go back in time because your life story is so compelling. You were a boy when your family fled the Nazis in 1932. Tell us about that time in your family's life.
Well, I was born in 32, and my mother was an actress, and my father was a doctor, and he was a communist doctor. And you have to know a little bit about what Berlin was like before Hitler really took power. Different enclaves within the city of Berlin were Nazi, some were communist, some were Weimar. And my father observed a bad operation done in a hospital where he was a doctor. The guy who did it was a Nazi who had been planted there in the hospital. And he gave testimony about this bad operation. The Nazis got mad, and they sort of picked him off the street, kidnapped him off the street. This is why my mother was pregnant. And they stuffed him in some jail. It's just probably the basement of a house, okay? Mm-hmm. So my father was Jewish, my mother was not. And my mother's family was still connected to the Weimar in some way. They were petty officials in the government. They managed to get him out. And then they shoved him across the border to Czechoslovakia.
And your family, you were lucky.
We
made it to New York in 1939.
We got out for a very special reason. There's a family in St. Louis, the Styx family, that ran a department store. And they gave bond. They gave bond to the American government. They said, look, we'll take 10,000 Jews. And if they get into trouble, we'll pay for them. Which was remarkable. Just imagine such a thing.
Were you welcomed when you arrived in New York in 39, you and your family?
Yes, of course we were. I think my mother made a wonderful mistake sending me to public school in Lederhosen. And this was the day the Germans bombed Rotterdam. That was the only time I ever sensed any hostility, but never anything else.
So, Ray Weiss, that's kind of the background. And moving into what you do today, I'm a radio person, obviously. I'm also a music lover. And I was fascinated to find out that a lot of your interest in hearing what's in space began with you listening to records and trying to figure out how to get the snap and crackle and pop out of the vinyl. What kind of things did you do to solve that problem? You were a kid.
By that time, I was probably 12 or so. And the war was over. And the streets of New York, especially downtown New York, were loaded with stuff coming back as war surplus stuff. And you go down to Cortlandt Street in New York, which no longer exists. It was near the World Trade Center.
Right.
Go here, a whole box full of transformers, another box full of capacitors, vacuum tubes, everything you could ever want, radar sets half disassembled. You bought stuff for nothing at all. If you could lug it down the subway home, you got it, effectively. So I was able to get all sorts of junk like that. And I started making all sorts of stuff, radios, hi-fi sets, which didn't exist, you know. And so what happened is I built something, and I would invite some of the émigrés, because they were very interesting music, come over and listen to this. We would hear the New York Philharmonic, and these people were just blown away. I mean, imagine, they said, we're like in the concert hall. And so they wanted one. So the first one, a good friend of our family, make me one. So I made one for her. And then some friend of hers says, I want one too. And so little by little, this thing grew into a business.
You were kind of there at the start of the audiophile revolution.
That's right. If I had not gone to college, I probably could have made some money. But what got me to go to college was the problem that you raised. Vinyl wasn't there yet. It was shellac records
right.
that made that horrible. Yeah, 78s, right. Yeah, they had a very much rougher surface than the vinyl. And so they would have this, you have a Beethoven sound you want to hear. You had Schnabel. When you get to the slow movement, all you heard was that goddamn record scratch. So the thing was, how do you get rid of that? And that was a puzzle that I was just beyond me. I couldn't do it. I didn't know enough math. I didn't know enough real electrical engineering. And effectively, that drove me to college. Let's face it. I want to solve that problem.
That's incredible. So since then, you've had a long, illustrious career, including building a sort of massive antenna so sensitive it could detect faint, invisible ripples in space from 1.3 billion years ago. For those of us not really well-versed in physics, describe the importance of this discovery with LIGO.
Well, first, let me say something, that it wasn't me who built it. You make it sound like I was this incredible person. A lot of other very good
people.
Let's take cognition of it. What did we discover? What did we all discover? We knew black holes existed, but we established that black holes live in pairs. They some of them do. Nobody knew that beforehand. The other thing is that we found we are able to detect gravitational waves directly. Now, they had been seen before by indirect methods. Very beautiful experiments had shown that they were gravitational waves. That's not the issue. It was not, quote, the discovery of gravitational. That had been known. But the fact is that you could actually make an instrument that could detect them. That has a very big significance in a minute. And then the most important thing to me, that may not be so important to others, is that the Einstein equations, those equations that he struggled over in 1915, and he really agonized over them. And he didn't know anything about black holes. He didn't know about this. He didn't know how strong gravity. It worked for gravity that he understood. You know, gravity in our own solar system, the Earth we live on. But here is an extreme case where gravity is all there is, and things are moving damn near the velocity of light, and it still works. And now that the equations are still good in that extreme regime, to me, it's just spectacular. And so, to me, one of the dreams I have is would have been, had Einstein been still alive, is to tell him about this. I would have loved to see what he would have thought about and what his expression would be, you know?
Rainer Wise, professor emeritus at MIT. He's one of three winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. I knew that old interview would come in handy again. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.